lots of preparation. We'll see what comes out. So this evening I'd like to explore a bit more deeply the whole direction of non-duality and what that might mean for us. Being aware that right now we're in a time of great struggle and pain. There's a war going on. There is a huge amount of suffering. It's in the background of all our minds. And we can all feel the conflict and the pain that causes, and in many ways the blindness that creates war and has created wars from the beginning of time. It's not just today. There's a sad episode in the life of the Buddha. He managed to stop two wars by just going out and confronting the armies and somehow using his presence to stop. And then the third time, when a local king came with an army to and killed all the people in his own kingdom, all his own people, men, women, children, all killed by another king, a massacre. And he stayed in his orchard somewhere. And the monk said, "Why didn't you stop this? They're killing all your people." He said, "Some things I cannot stop. The karma is too strong. There's nothing I can do. There's no way I can stop this." And so we're faced with a situation which is beyond us. And it's important to kind of have that at the background, that we can feel our personal pain, but there's something there that is beyond us, that is not something that we can fix. Not one of us is able to stop this. We can all contribute, we can all do what we can, we can reduce the pain, we can help, we can, and we do, and many of us do. But there's still, it points to something bigger than us, which is imperfection, suffering, struggle. And then it really opens lots of questions. That is the world unfixable? Really? You can't fix it. It's like, and then happiness just comes as a relief now and then, and mostly we're busy with struggle, and then happiness comes as a kind of gift if we are good children. And it asks us, these questions really come up. I have to say that this retreat as a non-dual retreat is the only non-dual retreat in the year. So I'm not going to talk much more about the conflict right now. And we've all the Dharma teachers here in Israel have been talking about it non-stop. There's, since October, all of us have been hundreds and hundreds of talks and engagement and action, and you can find them, but in this retreat, I do want to keep the direction of the non-dual. So I want to do it in this way, to say that the point of view of a kind of unfixable world that looks like endless tragedy and then moments of relief and happiness is very much a point of view of the person, of the self, of the me, that looks at the world and says, "Oh my God." It's a self point of view, it's a human point of view, it's the me point of view. me as a human being, me as an Israeli, me as a growing up in this way, me as this belonging to this people, me in this part of the world, me, it doesn't matter what, me with the conditioning from childhood, me as the stories that I have, that I carry, personal and community stories. And this personal point of view, there's something fundamental about the personal point of view. And here we're not talking about only you as a human being. Every being, in a way, has a personal point of view. Every animal, every bird, fish, even insect, bacteria, has a personal point of view, which says, I want to survive. I am. And the survival mind is integrated into the personal point of view. Once we are born in a body, the survival mind is going to be dominant, as a dominant voice in us. And from there comes a lot of the struggle and suffering, and struggle to be happy. The traditional teaching of the worldly winds, the winds of the world. Once we're born in a body, we're going, and again, not just humans, but any being is going to be swept by winds of wanting to live and not to die, of wanting and not to be losing, of wanting to be part of a group, part of and not separated. And these are the worldly winds. When I was a kid, I used to love, I'm not so proud of this, but I did used to watch lines of ants. And then I would take a stick and move one ant out of the line. And it went into a panic, trying to get back to the line. And I really thought, well, that's us. We don't want to be pushed away or lost or separated or whatever. And so we are in suffering from waves of difficulty, pain, survival mind, and then we have the possibility of going to somewhere else, of being beyond that, of being in another place. And one of the places that is helpful to us is the non-personal point of view. And that's where the non-duality comes in. A point of view that isn't based on the person, on the me, my stories, my narratives, my history, my self, my identity, my experiences, and that, blah, blah, but is actually a life point of view. Not so long ago, I was talking to one of my grandchildren, and I was quite impressed. I remember her at the age of 14, when she was pretty miserable about what's going on in the world. And now at the age of 17, I was talking to her recently, and I said, you're in a happy state. Despite everything going on in the world, you look so happy. And she said, yes, I know. Because I know all these issues that are happening now, and the climate change and everything, the difficulty. But life is wiser than us. And life knows what to do. And life will keep going. We may not, but life will still keep going. And that makes me happy. Oh, well. She should be the Prime Minister. So, the life point of view is beyond the duality of good for me or bad for me. It's the tree of good and bad in the Garden of Eden, that we ate the apple we ate the apple, meaning we, or the fruit of this tree, meaning we took it in, the good and the bad, which really means good for me, bad for me. There isn't, it's not about theoretical good and bad. It's about good for me, bad for me. And there is a place where that's less relevant, and that's a life point of view. Shakespeare said it. There is no good and bad. It's only thinking that makes it. And there's beautiful quotes. And Elijah is the carries the quotes of Rumi in her mind, and one is just says the same thing. There is a field beyond good and bad. I'll meet you there. So the duality of good for me, bad for me, is not good and bad theoretically as a concept or as a philosophy. It's good for me or bad for me. It's about how we receive the pleasant and unpleasant. And an impersonal point of view, a life point of view, tells us that we are made from the universe. And we don't notice it, we don't think about it, but we are made. There is nothing else here except the universe. Earth, air, fire, water, consciousness put together like kind of like a potter. Sankara is the Pali word, but the image is the potter, pottery. But we put together, and then from the universe, and then we think, ah, here we are. And then we forget that we're pieces of the universe walking about. The Buddha once said, all you are is a load of porridge walking about. That was exactly the words, a load of daisa walking about. And nirvana, liberation, is defined as return to the universe. The fire, the burning fire of being the me and struggle and in need and in neediness and in good for me, bad for me, and this whole struggle of being, which is seen as fire in the image, and nirvana is putting out the fire, meaning the fire goes back to where it came from, which is the universe. So it's not that duality is a problem. It's not that we have to kind of deny, someone quite wisely asked in the group, does that mean in non-duality, does that mean diversity, the richness of all the many million things in the world, is a problem? That we have to ignore it and think of everything as being one porridge? No, diversity is actually inviting us again to go beyond the personal. Because it says that there's the millions of things that appear, disappear all the time. And that's like one great diverse universe. If there's no conflict, diversity is no problem. So the classical practice in the Buddhist world and in many other spiritual journeys is to kind of work with the basic humanness, the suffering, and it's for us today, here in time of war, the way we can do this is to see it as a call to wake up. A wake-up call. When there's suffering, suffering tells us, go there. There is the place you need to look. And it's a wake-up call to us. What are we going to do? How are we with it? Where are we going to take it? What's the message? Where is it leading us? Where are we leading it? And often the more suffering that there is, the more it's urgent to wake up. And very often people who are the greatest Buddhist teachers and spiritual teachers, their journey has been fired and been fast because of immense suffering that they went through. And the suffering was strong, and it just gave them so much, because there's nowhere else to go. It's the end of the sort of illusion. And the tradition says, big suffering, you've got a choice. Even, and also little suffering, you've got a choice. You either go to search or to misery. Where do you go? And certainly the first kick that the Buddha got to kick himself out of his comfort, his palace and his enjoyment, was seeing the messengers that brought suffering, death and sickness and poverty. So the suffering and the difficulty is like the elephant in the room. We need to expose it. We need to see it. We need to call it by its true name. We need to look at it inside ourselves. Instead of letting, for example, the anger, the fear, the anxiety, instead of letting them just work in us unconsciously and basically ruining our life, and often giving a lot of pain to other people as well, we need to call things by their true name and see them as they are and give them space. And that's what a lot of this kind of practice is doing, and that's what you're doing here. We're all doing here, giving things space. The difficulty needs to be seen and held and acknowledged and worked with and taken responsibility for. And so we do need to look at our stories and our narratives and what's coming up. We need to work with them. And slowly, slowly, to be able to see that they are not made of stone, that they are flexible, and we can work with them, and they are passing, and we can hold them with awareness and with compassion. And that's the basic practice of Dharma practice, of Vipassana practice, of mindfulness practice. The going to non-duality, though, goes to another, a further place. It's like once you see the elephant in the room, you also see the room. So the non-dual practice will give you a sense of what is the room in which the elephant is hiding and then exposed. When you see the elephant, you see the room. It's inviting us to have a direct experience of what is not in the personal level, of life level, of existence, existential, rather than the personal. And it's out of the world of concepts, it's not in the world of thinking about, it's not in a world of philosophy. It's not really about time, it's not about trying to fix things. It's not about effort. It's not any of these places which are the normal human need for getting things better. It's not in that category. It's somewhere else. It's a deep sense of allowing life to be what it is, to say, it's all bigger than me, I let go, I just surrender into this life. What is it? Just this moment, this being, this existence right now, this sense of being alive, this sense of being, this sense of togetherness, belonging to the world and us as one thing. And we're looking at things less with the personal eyes and more like looking at things from a life point of view. Life is looking out of our eyes. Actually, life is looking out of our eyes at life, because it's nowhere else. And we can touch it. It's not that difficult, because there's places in us which are very just quiet, when nothing much is happening, where we're just sitting under a tree, where we just have one breath, and in between one breath and another breath there is a moment of just being, and in between one thought and the next there is a bit of relief, and it's actually places which we can touch. It's not so difficult, doesn't seem. It's the language maybe is difficult, but we all, our basis is life. On there is the story, but the base is life, the ground is life. And it can be a moment. My first retreat with Lama Surya Das on Tibetan non-duality, Dzogchen, about 20 years ago. And one of the things that we practiced was the shout. And the shout, "But!" That's it. And at that moment, something stops. And it's beautiful to go through. And that's only a moment. But the moment the mind stops, stops being a person, stops the story. So it can be a moment. So what is it that can invite us there? How do we go to that place? What are the ways which we can discover? The first thing I would say is the negatives. And we easier to talk about the negative, which is not this, not this, not this, not this. It doesn't really quite tell us what to do, actually. But it gives a sense with not about it's letting go of striving, of pushing, of seeing that our spiritual life is hard work. It's not about hard work or effort to be better or to get better or to fix things. It's not in that category, because that's the same human mind that causes a lot of the problems in the first place. Wanting to control. And in there is, you know, the time, it needs time, and I've done one retreat, then another retreat. How many retreats do I have to go in order to awaken? It's a sense of a track, and a sense of, and this is out of that. It's the now, one breath is good enough. That's a Zen phrase. An Indian Buddhist Mahayana teacher said, when you practice, there's nothing special to be practiced. just don't see anything wrong or any defect anywhere. Take nothing to heart and don't long for signs of progress. Although this effortlessness may seem like not paying attention or not practice, is actually just simply don't fall into not absent-mindedness and not being present. Just remain attentive through constant, unwavering mindfulness. Just constant mindfulness. And then the rest happens by itself, without the pressure for signs of progress and so on. Slowly, slowly, we may begin to get a sense or a hint, what I would call the default place in us. And the default is just simply, I am. I exist. Under all the stories, under all who I am, under the identity. And it's every one of us knows that place. I am. Hineni. It's so direct and so simple, and that's our default. And I'm working with scientists and working on research on meditators, including myself. And we talk a lot about the sense of self under the story, a kind of a basic sense of self that doesn't have a story in it. On top of that, there is all the stories of who I am, what I am, my identity, my memories, my needs, my life. But underneath, there is a place with no story at all. It's just, here I am. And that's just kind of a default place that we all know. You can call it a primal, more primal place. It's like the water under the earth in the aquifer, the groundwater, comes out in all kinds of ways. In the tap, in spring water, pools, the rain, but under the ground is a huge resource of water. And it's our underground. And it can be the way to kind of make contact with our sources is really just to kind of drop into them. We can't really look for this place. We just drop into it, or we drop out of everything else. So we drop out of all our stories and we just drop into that place of, here I am, that's it. It's almost like we give up. And sometimes it's great to give up. The whole meditation is not working, the whole thing is terrible, it's just not, nothing is happening, I can't concentrate on my breath, I can't, don't know what I'm doing here, I give up. That's it, you're there. And in a way, it's our meeting of consciousness. Consciousness or basic awareness. Traditional image is like the sky or like the ocean. And it gives birth to forms. So our consciousness is just awareness that has no color or shape or place or boundaries. Where's the end of awareness? Where is it? We can't put it in any box. Awareness is just the potential of knowing. And it doesn't have, as I say, any shape or color or attributes. Tchunot doesn't have any attributes. But it gives birth. It gives birth to thought. Just like the ocean gives birth to waves, so that awareness gives birth to thought, to forms. The sky behind the clouds, they're clouds, but the sky is endless. In practice, it's witnessing more and more, to be in this witnessing place. Not so easy. In the groups today, some of you were asking, well, but I experience these experiences and they're, in a way, stopping me from practicing or from meditating, whatever. And all I'm doing in my job as a kind of helping is to say, pay attention, be the witness of the problem instead of the sufferer of the problem. Step back from the issue called tiredness or whatever it is. Step back and be the witness. The witness just knows. The witness is just there. The witness says, okay, this is what's happening right now. That's a very kind of clean place. That's the consciousness that says, okay, I see forms, I see expression of life. There's a nice image of in talking about thinking as forms. Forms that arise out of, are born out of the mother. The mother is the consciousness or the awareness, gives birth to forms, children, thoughts. But if we ask what is a thought, we pay attention to what is a thought. We can trace it back. We can look and see where does this thought come from? What's the mother of this thought that arises? The consciousness makes thought, which is the, if you like, invisible or ground, is giving birth to form. The unmanifest makes the manifest. And it's a place, normally we look, we are in the place of the waves, looking at the, we are in the place of the ocean looking at the waves. So we just look at waves, and we're the ocean and there's waves coming. But the other way around is the waves look at the ocean. So a thought can say, where does that come from? The wave is saying, where do I come from? What am I made from? Where is my source? And the wave then turns to the ocean, say, ah, okay. So we can do that in some way. We can touch it. And we do that by letting thought just come and go and be itself. Not trying to shift it and change it and shut it up and not being censoring it and trying to dress it up in other clothes and get fed up with these stories in my mind. But instead of that, just letting it come and go. Doesn't need to do anything to us. I know it's not so easy, but it doesn't. We can maybe get a hint. The thought doesn't need to do anything. It comes and goes by itself. The Tibetan image of this is a thought is like a thief wanting to come into a house but the house is empty, so there's nothing to steal. So I know that might sound, you know, a little bit esoteric if and new to you and some of you, but just kind of put it in the back of the mind somewhere. If we don't disturb thought, thought will not disturb us. If we don't disturb thinking, thinking will not disturb us. We let thinking come and go, which is a very big thing because everything seems to be around thinking. We can't imagine anything without thinking. But there's a freedom there that if we don't disturb thought, it will not disturb us. And we will gradually be able to see where this thought comes from because we're not busy in the thought and struggling with it and fighting it. And so it isn't so different from Vipassana, actually, because in Vipassana or in classic Dharma teaching, we also talk about watching thought come and go, watching things having kind of a short shelf life, chaye madaf. We also talk about it, and it's just here that we take it further and then become interested in the witness, in the witnessing itself, in the mother, not just the child, in the ocean, not just the waves. And because it's made, thought is made of the same stuff as awareness, in the end it has to be perfect too. We may think, well, that's impossible. An angry thought, how can that be perfect? But if we look, an angry thought is simply consciousness in a form built through me, the filter of me. Another way that we can practice and we can go towards towards the non-duality is actually to kind of confuse the mind, to get the mind stuck. Who is it, Byron Katie? Does she do that? Asking the question, is it really so?
Yes.
Is it her that...
Is that the truth?
Hmm?
Is that the truth?
Yeah, is that the truth? Is it really so? Just asking that question is already undoing the mind. Just ask it, is it really so? You could, it's a process. It just undoes things. It undoes our belief that this thought is true. No, wait a minute, is it really so? And if we kind of, you know, have beliefs like, I need to succeed, success and failure, and what I need to do and who I am and so on, it gets very strong. Is it really so? Is this who I really am? Is this thought real and true? So it's an atmosphere of inquiry. I was delighted the other day to watch one of my favorite Buddhist films of all time. It's really an old film, made in Korea. And a Korean Zen hermitage. And it was, I think it's about 50 years old, this film. It's called Why Did Bodhidharma Go to the East? And it was really, what's impressive was that there was a group of monks in this hermitage in the mountains. And they were busy all day. They didn't meditate. They were gardening, herding the cows, they were collecting the herbs, they were making medicines for themselves, they were making tea, they were running the whole thing. And no meditation. when you listen to what they were doing, they were simply asking themselves an impossible question, a koan. They were given a koan, and with that koan, that impossible question, they were cutting wood and digging the garden and growing their vegetables and cooking in the kitchen and cleaning. And in the background was a question that undoes the mind, that the mind couldn't cope with, a question that makes them go beyond the mind to a place which is not in the known, is beyond the known. And when you go beyond the known, you're back into this existential place of just being, with the mind not being able to work it out. And I have to say, after 40 years of meditation practice, more, that I see my mind as a purely functional agency, just like a hand. That's all. And if I don't need it, it won't. It doesn't do. It doesn't. It's not there. It's purely functional and limited. Sorry, mind. My mind. I hope you'll forgive me. But it's really, this is definitely one way that's very legitimate inside the practice, which is really trying to go beyond where the mind can take us, to come out of the illusion of thought. And if you know, Krishnamurti was one of my first teachers, and that's his method, inquiry. And that's all he says. He doesn't teach meditation. He teaches inquiry. Check it out. Look carefully. Is it really so? And it creates mystery and creates a sense of not knowing. But it's not knowing at the level of mind, and it's a deep knowing at the level of conscious awareness. The deeper knowing becomes more important than the knowing of the mind that says this is this and this is that. The Buddha was once asked, how do you recognize an enlightened person? And he answered, you recognize them because you can't find them. So the question, well, what does that mean? Well, they don't exist. No, they exist very well. They're alive and well. But you can't find them because there's no description that fits anymore. Every description, every word, every category, every definition is simply gone. So you can't find the person anymore. Another place that the first words that I said in this, and other teachers here too, in this retreat, was resting. And it's more important than just having a bit of a rest because we're tired. Resting is very powerful if we really get into it. And you heard, yeah, that now I remember that you did hear about the retreats of Jaya. When she does maybe a month of resting, deep rest. Because deep rest is resting from the pressure to be somebody and to think things, to believe things, to define things, to try and sort things out. To try and get things better, to try and make sense of everything. And it's resting from that pressure. And where do you rest to? There is only one place that you rest into awareness, into being. You rest from that pressure of struggle, of being human being, resting from that Even it's illusion, the illusion, you can rest in illusion. It's illusion, yes, it's not. What's reality? Never mind, I'm taking a rest. I'm just resting. It does say something very powerful, a powerful truth, which is shocking in a way to our usual beliefs and who we think we are and what we think we need to do in life, which is, in the end, there's really nowhere to go. Everywhere that we can say, I have to go there or be that, or there's illusion in that. There's nowhere to go, so we might as well just rest. Please don't argue with me about that. And I'm sure many of you are thinking, how can that be? But just put it at the back of the mind, okay? You don't have to believe anything I'm saying. But put it at the back of your mind and maybe ask the question, where really am I going? What do I really want? Where am I really going somewhere? Just, you know, put it as a question. The Buddha taught non-duality as well as teaching duality, dual practice. The Sulam, he taught that non-stop, but he also taught non-duality. Like I said, the first words that he said when he awakened were unborn, unmade, unconstructed. It's all unborn. And I think that anything that takes us beyond our usual boundaries will bring us there. And the Buddha kept on talking about that. About things being endlessly connected. There isn't any person, really. Because we are made of the world and we are constantly being remade by the world again and again. Every breath we take, we're breathing the world. Every bit of water is coming in us and going out of us. There isn't any moment where we're not just made by and remade by conditions. And so is all beings and so is everything else. And that's so fundamental to the teaching and it's so basic to non-duality. There isn't things in the world. There is processes that are constantly remaking everything. And being made by everything. There isn't anything really. And that's such a it's so radical, but it goes to the same place that there is only life, there isn't actually in the end me and you. And it's the right view, the first of the Eightfold Path, it says it. So it's really inherent in the original Buddhist teaching. This is not just a kind of Advaita teaching. This is inherent also in the earliest teaching of the Buddha. So, final few words. How can we take this teaching? What are we going to do with this? Because a lot of what I've said, you would just maybe don't know where to put it. And the first thing I think is just let it touch us somewhere as being mystery. That we don't have to believe it or we don't have to, but we can sense that there's a place there that is mysterious and interesting and beyond, and kind of let it be there in. And it can lift us up when we're down. It can actually help to inspire us a bit. Just like the story of my granddaughter. from a life point of view, there is relief in that. There is some sense of I can't fall all the way down because life is still holding me. And a second thing is that when we are practicing, and we're practicing dualistically, that we want more peace, we want more concentration, we want our meditation to be better, we want to deal with our tiredness or deal with our issues, we want to develop inside. And it's fine. It goes together with the non-duality. The two go together. It's not we have to abandon every sense of development, tipuach, of development of qualities in us. That's part of the practice, but this, the non-duality, can be inspiring as a ground. All the non-dual teachers, Advaita teachers, the Buddha himself, had years and years of dualistic practice before coming to a non-dual place. And they go together. And maybe, slowly, slowly, we move from a dualistic practice to a more non-dual practice. But we can always be inspired by the big picture. Even if we're in development and we're working with issues and problems, and yet behind can be this big picture that gives us support. And it grows and grows and grows as we practice. The witnessing grows and grows and grows. It takes more and more and more space. And final word, formless or limitless or infinite, which you could equate with awareness, that is the source or that is the mother of form. Actually, what happens is the formless and the form are in dialogue. And we can feel that it's not that the formless is right up there, it is the only place, and the form, well, we just have to kind of deal with that and get. They are actually in dialogue with each other. The form and the formless are all the time in communication. They're talking to each other. This is in the Heart Sutta. If you know about the Heart Sutta, it's just basically saying form and formless are in connection to each other. So the form and the formless, the mother and the child, are in contact. The thought influences the consciousness. The consciousness is giving birth to thought. And we can just kind of somehow stay with that, with whatever it means to us. Just get a sense that we are in both places, the infinite place, the universal place, and the form place, and let them talk to each other. Thank you. So take a couple of minutes of quiet.